Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the Indian Religions Podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. John Nemec, who's associate professor in the Department of Religious Studies at UVA, the University of Virginia. We will be speaking with him about a brand new OUP publication that's part of the AAR Religion and Translation series, of which John is an editor. We'll be speaking about his second volume in this a series of his work called The Ubiquitous Shiva, Somananda's Shiva Drishti and His Philosophical Interlocutors, Volume 2. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So how did you fall down this rabbit hole of studying Somananda? What happened there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I came into Indian studies by accident. I took a course in college at the University of Rochester, somewhat inaptly titled Asian Search for Self, because I thought it was going to be about East Asia, about China. And it ended up being about South Asia and Hinduism and Buddhism, taught by Douglas Brooks. And I just fell in love with the topic. So I continued on, studying there, and then I went to Nepal for study abroad. I decided I wanted to work on these things, I thought, and I figured, but I really should see the place and the people who were, Hindu and Buddhist. I didn't know many Hindus or Buddhists in my college days. And I went to Nepal thinking I was going to work on Buddhism, and I ended up becoming fascinated with Bhairav, they call him, the god Bhairava, in the Kathmandu Valley and around it, and really just became interested in Hinduism and the esoteric brand Tantric Hinduism. So that was sort of just stumbling along, and then studied Sanskrit in graduate school and so on, because obviously it was necessary. And honestly, I knew this text existed. Somananda is the founding author of this philosophical school called the Pratibhidya, the recognition school. The most famous representatives of which are Utpaladeva and then Abhinavagupta. But here we have the great grand guru of Abhinavagupta with this famous text published in the Kashmir series of texts and studies in 1934 and really hardly dealt with. And I heard it was hard. And that seemed like a good idea to try and do something difficult. And it seemed like an obvious choice to try to see what the first text in this very, very influential philosophical line had in it. And so I picked in that way, honestly. I wanted to know what was there, and I wasn't sure. And it was an adventure. And then I spent 15 years working on it.
Yes, and why don't you tell the listeners what it is that you ended up producing? Because more than just a translation, there was tons of work involved in actually establishing the text, yes? Tell us a bit about the process.
Yeah, okay, sure. So it's at its base, the project is text critical. And so what I'm trying to do is understand as best as we possibly can with as much of the evidence that we could gather what Somananda might have thought and written. And, you know, there's an Aditya Princeps, there's an original published edition of the text, but it's only based on two handwritten manuscripts. And as I'm sure your listeners know, much of the Indian tradition is passed orally, but also then in manuscript form. And then we get texts in published form with written published form, but there are a lot of variants in what's written in a verse, a passage of text, a passage of commentary. And to understand what might have been originally intended, and that's a little dangerous to get at original intent, the author's intent, because it's speculative, but to try and get there, we can know things for sure, and some things we're not totally sure that we know, but we can put all the evidence out and let people make their own minds up. So what I did was to gather from around India mostly, also a couple of libraries in Europe, in the West, I gathered as many examples, copies of this text as I could find. And they're written in various Indian scripts, including principally Sharada, which is the particularly Kashmiri script, very beautiful, but also South Indian scripts. And Devanagari. And I basically went through and compared every line of these manuscripts, about a dozen of them, and looked line by line and looked through it. And in a few places, I posit that all the materials we have can't hold what was originally there. There must have been a mistake. So one can imagine, you know, the I skipped, there are two cuz in a row, and the I skipped one of them, this kind of thing. And there are maybe 8 or 15 places, something like that, where I posit readings for which we have no evidence, but I think are absolutely necessary. And the last thing I want to say about this is I record in the edition, the critical edition, all of the readings of all of the manuscripts positively. So there's no question at all as to what all the manuscripts read. So that's a way of saying there's a humility in that, right? Where you say, I think this is what was said. I think this is what we have to understand here. However, I'm going to furnish all of the data so that if someone wants to come to a different conclusion, they can.
I believe it was in a podcast interview with Peter Bishop and Yuko Yokochi on the Skanda Purana project, where one way to think of a critical edition is our hypothesis, right? This is what we hypothesize as a cogent text. And so there is that. It's clear, having done a number of interviews with folks who have far more patience than I do, that's for sure, who do critical editions, there is this toiling to arrive at a critical edition that is tacitly accepted, because added to it are the variants and the possibilities. And so I find that a really intriguing process.
Yeah, I don't know why I love it, but I do. And I guess
somebody has to. God bless you, John.
Somebody has to do it. But it really is really a privilege to look at this piece of paper, you know, or palm leaf, whatever it is. It's probably several hundred years old very often, or at least 100 years old in almost every case, and see what somebody else thought was important to write down. I mean, everything was hand-copied. So I find it, you know, a privilege and very enjoyable. I'm also really indebted to Madhusudan Kol Shastri, the person who made the 1934 publication, because he made the same kinds of choices I'm making. He didn't record explicitly his corrections or emendations, but now I have had access to certainly the main principal manuscript he read from. And you can see all the places where he cleared things up, used his judgment, and, you know, we're deeply indebted to him. So in my edition, I record everything he gives us as well. And then the last thing I wanted to say is this idea of, you know, Patantra, you know, another reading and having a variant. This is in the tradition itself too. So it's not, sometimes people think it's like a modern Western thing and an imposition, but the reality is this goes into, you know, the indigenous tradition in India of transmission of texts.
That's a great segue for my next question. Speaking of the indigenous tradition in India, to our knowledge, is there a living tradition where this text is used?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this because you had noted that, you know, it would be worth thinking about for whom this book might be written. And indeed, you know, it's surprising to me. I wrote an article a number of years ago that I thought was purely historical of a tradition long gone. It was on the Tridasha Dhamara Tantra. Out of the blue, a month or two ago, somebody wrote and said that they're still doing the pujas, the rituals of that tradition, and that they keep my article because it brings to light, you know, an unpublished text that only exists in, I think we only have two manuscripts left of it, manuscript copies of it left of it that I know of, or that maybe anyone knows of in the world. And that was, you know, really striking to me, right? We all famously know that India never forgets. And so the tradition is deep and perdures. This tradition of this esoteric Shaiva non-dual philosophy, I think has had a wide reach historically and down to the present day. It's been an inspiration for a number of modern yogic guru traditions. Of course, there's the famous Swami Lakshman Ju, who has, of course, passed away some decades ago, but was a living representative of this tradition, and that remains. So I do think that there are practitioners who are interested in this material, not just in an academic way.
I think it's fascinating, the cross-pollination in this particular case of that article you wrote, that in you studying the text and producing scholarship on it, you ended up giving back to the community of practitioners who are then, where's the line, right? It's fascinating, the exchange between the two. This publication of yours is the second volume. Tell us about that. Pan out a bit and tell us about the larger project.
Well, so it's the Shiva Drishti, or Vision of Shiva, that's a loose translation, is in seven Ahnikas, or daily lessons. And in the published edition is 220 pages long. And my dissertation dealt with the first part of it. This book deals with, I would say, the middle part of it, but there still remain, of those 220 pages of the published edition, I think there's still about 50 pages to go. So I do anticipate finishing the job in a third volume down the road. This is, as I said earlier, this is the first text in this famous Pratipigya, or recognition school of philosophy. It's Somananda is the immediate teacher of Utpaladeva, who's the grand guru of Abhinavagupta. And it's a very famously a work that mixes registers. The Shiva Drishti speaks to in a number of voices in a number of ways, including speaking in a kind of theological voice and also speaking in a much more strictly philosophical voice, a voice of logic and argument. So this part two marks a transition in the text. It deals with the fourth Ahnika, or the fourth chapter, and its commentary. The commentator is Utpaladeva. And it marks a transition from what came before, which looked a lot more in tantric theology and the language of tantric theology. Here we're really dealing with philosophical schools, mainstream non-tantric philosophical schools in Buddhism and Hindu tradition. And the second thing that distinguishes this volume is the commentator tells us that whereas in the first part of the book, my volume one, the goal was to deal with opposing schools, here the endeavor is to make a positive claim, to positively argue for, not to defend the tradition, but to logically prove make arguments for the argument of the book, which is that everything exists as Shiva.
Wonderful. I will definitely link your first book, volume one of this project, in the podcast notes in case folks are interested in following this trilogy, and the finale is coming up at some point. We'll have you back on the podcast when that one's out. So who are, there's a question I have that's been niggling in the back of my brain, and I'm not sure how to ask it because I don't want to ask a leading question. Is it surprising that no one studied this text, scarcely anyone, given the significance of this tradition, given the significance of Somananda? Is it surprising that this has received such little scholarly attention?
I mean, yes and no, right? On the one hand, it's a little bit the analogy I've used when applying for a grant and that kind of thing. Is, you know, in Greece we have this tradition, you know, from Socrates to Plato to Aristotle, and Plato and Aristotle have received a lot of coverage, but Socrates, we don't have original texts, only a representation in Plato and so on. Whereas here we have the analog to Socrates, we have Somananda, and it's lying there waiting for us. So on the one hand, it's absolutely unusual that it wasn't sort of, particularly given, you know, European, Western interest in origins in religion, and that's problematic in its own ways, but it's surprising in a way that this hasn't been taken up. But there are two reasons to understand why. The first one is that the tradition itself somewhat leaves it to the side in favor of Utpaladeva's articulation of the tradition and Abhinavagupta's commentary on Utpaladeva. And we see this in, you know, the Sarvadarshana Sangraha, this collection of, this doxographic work collection of summaries and critiques, critical summaries of other schools. The Pratibhigya that they give, it's really leaning into Utpaladeva and not Somananda. So we have this kind of supersession of the Shiva Drishti within the tradition itself to some degree. And then this is probably related to the second reason that it hasn't been studied, which is that it really is difficult work. And one of the things that makes it difficult is that the commentary becomes lost after the middle of the fourth chapter. And so it's been argued and suggested that one can't really read the Shiva Drishti without an extant commentary. And Abhinavagupta wrote a commentary on the text, which is completely lost, excepting for a few stray quotations. And Utpaladeva wrote a complete commentary on the text, and it's lost roughly halfway through the book. So there are real difficulties of interpretation, and it can feel like decipherment rather than translation when working through the text. So I think there are natural reasons to move to other things. And then there are practical reasons as well. It's just difficult work.
So who were Somadeva's interlocutors?
Well, so Somananda, in this second volume, is dealing with philosophical schools that were of purchase outside of any esoteric tradition. So these are what we could call like a mainstream philosophical school. He's deeply interested in the Buddhist epistemology, in Buddhist logic, in the person of Dharmakirti in particular. And in a way that my book argues anticipates what Utpaladeva does there, which is really important because Utpaladeva is really a great philosopher. But maybe owes a little bit more to his teacher than we had known prior to what I'm trying to argue here. He also deals with the Mimamsakas, the Vedic hermeneutical school that has a philosophical side to it. The Sankhya school of Sankhya and Yoga is very, very well represented. And then what I call the realist Nyayikas and Vaisheshikas, Nyaya and Vaisheshika. These are the interlocutors that I found in these passages.
And so through your work, what is he saying? What is Somananda saying?
Well, I think he makes his case clearly. The commentator says he's going to make a positive case for his position. And the first verses of the text are laid out, of the fourth chapter, what's in this book, are laid out. And I suddenly realized that what he had laid out is a logical argument, a syllogism of five parts, according to the classic Nyaya model. And the argument he's trying to make in that syllogism, no one tells us, not commentator, not Somananda, that what is laid out in the beginning is a syllogistic argument. But I think it's there, and I make the case for it in the notes to the translation. And the syllogism is trying to prove that everything is comprised of, everything is Shiva. So it's an argument for non-duality. It's an argument for all of existence and all of being, our very essences or atmans or selves, being comprised of Shiva himself. And that's his argument.
Was there anything that particularly surprised you through this work about what you discovered?
Definitely. The largest surprise, and it'll probably sound small to people who haven't spent all their time working on Pratibhya philosophy and have other interests than are normal human beings. But for me, what was very surprising is the degree to which he dealt with Dharmakirti, the Buddhist epistemologist. And it's surprising because of his, I mentioned this idea of mixed registers. It's surprising because the beginning of the chapter 4 in this volume 2 that I've just published, sounds a lot like Shaiva theology. He's talking about Shiva. He's talking about Shakti, or things that are Shakta, empowered. And it sounds like a Purana, right? It sounds like a mythology almost in its vocabulary. It sounds like Shiva and Shakti and so on. But what he's really doing in those passages is arguing with Dharmakirti about the nature of existent things in the world. And this was fascinating to me, the degree to which he engaged Dharmakirti. And I think it's been underappreciated. And it's important because this school of philosophy, Pratibhya, has been heavily influenced by Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti and thought shaped it. The Buddhists here really shaped and influenced the Hindu tradition. And we know that from the work of several scholars who've done a lot on Utpaladeva, and then also Abhinavagupta. So to find it here was a surprise to me, in the degree that it's there.
Fascinating. Could you say a quick word about this seeming Puranic dimension, this narrative exchange? Could you say a little bit about that? What surprised you about that?
Well, I mean, other than, you know, reading particular passages, I'm not sure I have much more to say about it. It's just that his vocabulary sounds like Shaiva theology. He's talking about Shiva. He's talking about Shiva being identical to the phenomena in the universe. That's fine. And then he's talking about things that are empowered, or things that have power, or things that are power. Shakti, they're Shakta, he says. The two are identified. We have these scriptural passages in Shaivism that talk about Shiva never being separated from his Shakti, Shakti never being divorced from Shiva. And it sounds like that's what he's doing once again. So it looks a little bit like an anodyne passage, you know, just again talking about Shiva and Shakti. Let's say anodyne when we think about philosophy, right? But what he's really saying is that he disagrees with the Buddhists who make the claim that there are different types of phenomena in the world, some that are empowered to have an effect, and others that don't have that capacity. Somananda is saying, no, everything has a capacity in some way, even if the capacity is only to make itself known in consciousness. And so what he's doing is arguing a small, in a way minute, but also fundamental philosophical point, to try to narrow things down to one thing, so that everything can be of a single quality, everything can be of a single nature, and that nature is a dynamic Shiva's consciousness. But it does it at the beginning of this chapter with terminology that really sounds non-philosophical.
Yeah, one of the ideas I play with in my own research and teaching is the extent to which theology and philosophy are mythologized, or mythology and codes, consciously encodes theology and philosophy for the sake of accessibility or preservation of certain values or mass consumption. So that really intrigues me. Who's this book for? Like, who would you envision really benefiting from or needing or wanting to get this book?
I mean, here I'm very, very modest. I, you know, at some level would say that's
it's not for the whole world.
Yeah. Not for the whole world, probably for very few. But I mean, obviously people are interested in historical questions around Shaivism, the history of Hinduism. I think that obviously that's the first audience. So that's the narrowest gauge of, you know, scholars and graduate students, people who have that kind of interest. But, you know, we talked about this earlier, and I'm glad you asked this because I wanted to come back to it. I can imagine a wider audience of people who maybe even have a personal stake in religion. And, you know, I wanted to say that I've always tried in my work to be responsible historically, to be objective in the way that I approach my work. But I've always thought and thought about my work maybe being available to people who have other interests in mind. You know, I'm not a Shaiva. I'm not Hindu. And I remember all the time that the tradition isn't mine. But I try to write in a way that could be useful to people who practice, people who are interested in Shiva in a personal way. And so I tried to make my translations legible with the footnotes, of which there are probably too many, but there are many, having two audiences in mind, scholars who want to chase down parallel passages in other texts and that kind of thing, quotations, whatever, but also just general explanations that I think the argument is doing this or the other thing. For people who maybe don't read Sanskrit, but want to get at the ideas that are available here.
So
I have a double audience in mind. Maybe it reaches a wider audience, and I hope it does, but obviously that's not up to me.
Well, it's up to the grace of Shiva. those interested in all things Shaiva might well be interested in the book, because the translation is written in an accessible manner. The book is structured such that there are is a significant introduction to orient to. And then I think the translation comes next. And then there is the actual Sanskrit text in transliteration with all the various the variants and the notes. And so whether you are into manuscriptology or philology, or you want to understand the history of this tradition, I imagine it'll serve your interests. But also, as I say, if you have an interest in all things Shaiva, much like your cat does, apparently.
Yeah, sorry about my cat.
Why are you apologizing? this book might hold appeal. Could you say a word about the series?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do imagine it being used in different ways by different people. And so some people may go to the back and look at emendations and corrections and conjectures in the manuscript, in the edition, working with the manuscripts. I'm sure other people ignore it altogether, and I hope that it captures people with all those kinds of interests.
Excellent. Could you tell us a bit more about the AAR, that's American Academy of Religion, text and translation series that this book is a part of through OUP? Also, you're the editor of that series currently, so tell us a bit about that.
Yes. So there's something called, it used to be called the Texts and Traditions series, I think, and now the title of the book series is Religion in Translation. And the series has been entitled Religion in Translation for about 15 or 18 years now, maybe even slightly longer than that. The first volume came out in Religion and Translation under the editorship of Anne Monius. And due to that, historical fact, the second volume came out in this series as well. I have to say it's a little unusual to be the editor of the series in which one publishes one's own book. And I was quite wary about it, but Cynthia Reed, the editor for Religion at Oxford University Press, New York, obviously did all of the peer review and the editorial work. I didn't do it for myself. But Religion and Translation is a series of the American Academy of Religion and Oxford University Press. It is published by OUP New York and sponsored by the American Academy of Religion. So your listeners will know, I'm sure, that the American Academy of Religion is this largest scholarly academy for the academic study of religion in North America, but also with an international membership. And they sponsor 7 or 8 book series that focus in different areas of concern. This one is interested in works of translation. So it can be like the Religion and Translation can include things like my book that are translations. You have a target language is always English. We always translate into English, but from any tradition, any source language, any historical period, dealing with any issue in religion widely conceived, is eligible for inclusion in Religion and Translation. So translations of important works that deal with religion or are representative of religious phenomena or points of view. It also, Religion and Translation, takes up works that aren't like mine. They're not translations per se, they're monographs, scholarly monographs, but they use translation as a method or engage significantly in the work of translation in that wider sense of it, of taking something conceptually from one tradition or historical moment into another one. So there can be that kind of larger sense of translation dealing with texts. It can also be living tradition. It does not have to translate texts. You can translate anthropologically into English language for an English speaking audience.
So now that this second installment of the series is out, I imagine you're working on the third installment of this translation project. But let me not assume, and let me just ask, what are you working on next?
Right. So actually, I've taken a little break from Somananda. Where I am in the text, two-thirds or a little bit more through the whole thing, I'm now in the area where there's no commentary left. And so the work is slow, and unfortunately, one of the problems we have with no commentary being left is we also have very, very few manuscripts of the text after the commentary disappears. Because the majority of the manuscripts we have of the text are manuscripts that included the commentary. So I go from 12 to 2. And so we have fewer sources for clues as to what might have been said. So I am coming back to it soon, but in the meantime, it's been a long time coming into print. In the meantime, I've been working on a book that I finished that deals with the narrative literatures and looks at the relationship of Brahmins and kings, the representatives of religious authority and political authority in the narrative literatures. So that I hope to send out to a publisher very, very soon. And then I've been commissioned to work on a book on the state of, it's called Shaiva Tantra, The State of the Field. And this is for the Ludo and Roseanne Rocher Foundation. Have set up an Rocher Indology series. And within that series, they've set up a sub-series examines scholarly subfields and gives a critical review and prospects for those subfields. So yoga is an example of a subfield, and Shaiva Tantrism is another. So my ambition there is to sort of sum up what's happened in the study of Shaiva traditions, tantric traditions, over the last, let's say, 40 years. That's really when there's been a great interest in this. and identify lacunae, trends, possibilities, and so on, and also hopefully make that scholarship available to non-subspecialists in an easier way. So that's what I'm working on right now. And that should take a year or two, and then I'll come back to this.
That sounds fascinating, actually. Part of what's sort of done on the podcast, maybe inadvertently, is the tracking of trends, right? Seeing publications coming out, noticing, oh, wow, we've done 10 yoga books in the last year. Let's do an event at the OCHS, something along those lines. I mean, there is no rhyme or reason to whom I interview. As long as it's a reputable press and it's on my radar, then I'm happy to invite someone or someone will contact me, type thing. But I really like the idea of having a more systematic and critical look at subfields, because it really gives you the bird's eye view of what's happening, right? So that's really cool. Perhaps we can talk about that on the podcast at some point as well.
I mean, I'd imagine you have a view of the field that's, you know, you're very lucky to have a view of the field, wide view of the field that's probably very, very informed. You know, I should probably go listen to more of your podcasts than I have.
Since you've taken a little time out with Somananda, maybe you'll have the time. We'll see. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on today about your book?
No, you know, I mean, I thank you for your questions. I think it gives a good sense of what it is and what it's trying to do, and I really appreciate it.
Mission accomplished. You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for appearing on the podcast today. So for those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. John Nemec, who is Associate Professor at UVA, the University of Virginia. We've been speaking with him about his second installment of this important translation project called The Ubiquitous Shiva, Somananda's Shivadrishti and His Philosophical Interlocutors, Volume 2. It's a brand new OUP publication that's part of a series sponsored by the American Academy of Religion pertaining to translating texts. All the links, the relevant links, will be in the podcast notes. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the mystery of Shiva.